All right, welcome to the show, Pete. It's been literally like, I don't know, a decade or decades in the making for you and I to just have a conversation. I feel like we've been circling each other's, like, in this weird editorial sneaker streetwear world for a long time, man. Like, we've both been doing this a long time, so it's really cool to like actually get to chat with you. Obviously, you know, with the show, give people your backstory and introduce yourself. I have, like, you know, I'm in a weird spot, and I'm going to fumble my words because we've talked for so long before I hit record here. But
for the listener, we've been talking for an hour and 15 minutes.
Exactly. It's been great. I feel like it's just been like, oh, cool. Like, finally, I get to talk to somebody that understands and gets it and have similar experiences we can riff off of each other with. But no, man, I admired your work for a long time. You know, like, you've done some really cool stuff. You've gotten to even, I think, be a part of starting some really cool shit along the way, too. You know, for some of these companies that we all collectively, I would say, look to as like kind of like the voices of cool, you know, like in a lot of ways, whether that's streetwear or sneakers or, you know, just like general vibes with, like, you know, the culture of those kind of circulating things, let's say.
Sure.
So it's really cool to like get to chat with you. But I'm curious, like, how you got started in it with, you know, like both from a personal perspective and from a work perspective with like the sneakers and streetwear and just like, I don't know, it's just being you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have been interested in sneakers for as long as I can remember. I think I wrote a piece about this in like Soul Collector or something. When I was in third grade, I was new to a school, and it was a very small sort of like, by construction, a very cliquey school. And so the first time somebody sort of like paid me a compliment, it was about my sneakers in third grade. And I think that sort of like flipped a switch in my brain. But, you know, going from like a Montessori school in Connecticut, then to boarding schools in Connecticut and Western Massachusetts, there was not a whole lot of like streetwear culture. And then I went to acting school in New York, which again, like, there's not a huge crossover from, you know, sneakers and like even sports like basketball and like the kids who sing Les Mis. So it was just sort of like a background interest of mine. And then I was acting and doing work in film and TV, and I had some time. I didn't have a gig coming up and I was nervous. And then Ronnie Feig at Kith put on Instagram or Twitter that they were looking for an intern. And I just happened to have like my application package already together, because I had like written a thing about some shoe that Nike did to raise money for RED, the organization that raises money for AIDS research. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to like package this up within 30 minutes and fire it off to him. And I think by the end of the day, I had scheduled for an interview. I met him on Bleecker Street. We sat down at the Le Pain Quotidien, which I don't think is there anymore, for 45 minutes. He just sort of like talked at me for 45 minutes. And then at the end was like, it's yours if you want it. And I was like, okay. So it was a 6-month internship. After 3 months, I was like, bro, you gotta pay me because I'm running your company. Maybe I shouldn't say that. And then I went from that. I stayed there for a little bit over a year and then started writing for Complex, which led to writing for Soul Collector, which led to writing for Esquire and a bunch of other places I can't even remember off the top of my head. And then eventually I got hired at StockX after you had left to be the editorial director there. And I was there until 2022.
Nice, man. Did you relocate to Detroit for that StockX role, or is that...
So when that was the pitch,
yeah,
Josh had been pitching me on that for a while. And I wrote the article for Soul Collector that introduced the world to StockX. I sat down with him and the billionaire and they sort of explained it to me. And then I distilled it. And that was like the announcement of the company. And apparently, like, after we got off the phone, we hung up and Dan said to Josh, you got to hire that guy. So Josh, you know, was texting me all the time, come to Detroit. And I was like, bro, I live in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Why would I move to Detroit? And so eventually, after things were going in a different direction in my day job that I just wasn't really interested in anymore, I texted Josh and I was like, I'm interested in having this conversation. at this point, but Detroit is a non-starter for me. And so I went to Detroit to sort of give them my pitch on what I think they should do. And then I spent the first 2 months in Detroit as for onboarding. But at that point, they were opening up an office in New York. So nice. I worked out of the office for 2 months, and then COVID hit, and then everybody was remote. So it didn't end up being a problem.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, we'll jump back to some of the other stuff you talked about there, but I kind of forget the StockX, you know, my experience with StockX was, you know, like very similar. Josh was texting me, you know, like Josh and I had done a bunch of stuff with Complex and at Finish Line. Cause you know, like the data that he was doing with Campus he was the only person that was doing it on the level that we could present it, you know, customer facing for Finish Line, let's say, and for Complex too. But like, even with Complex in those early days, when he first started Campus, that really didn't resonate the way a lot of our other stuff was. Like at that time, you know, like we were, you know, like I signed up for Complex sneakers when I, on my phone, when like I kind of took the role. And we just started branching out into our own channels and really like focusing on like the kind of bigger picture. And like those data pieces were what I really thought was cool, because it's like finally some proof that the stuff that we all care about from like we can emotionally, I can get you excited about sneakers or a brand or story or whatever, because like I just like talking about those things and telling the stories and getting people excited. But I didn't have concrete evidence that it mattered to the masses. You know, like we knew we were doing crazy numbers of views on Complex, but like, you know, you look at that and, you know, from an editorial perspective, you know, we can look at traffic, but like, we're also looking for engagement. We're looking for ways for people to like jump into the conversation. And this is like before we really had like the full on Instagram is everything. So we kind of like dance between Facebook and Twitter and all of that. It sounds like we had very similar experiences though, because like I initially started with StockX before it was even a thing, you know, writing content for everything, emails, like, you know, like all that stuff. And then Josh was like, you got to come to Detroit. He flew out to San Francisco and we met in the city and had lunch. And, you know, I was like, I had been doing sneaker history, like I say sneaker history as a thing, but like people know, like it was really just a place for me and my buddies to write about shoes that wasn't influenced by the brands. Right. It was let's talk about the things that matter. We don't have to worry about advertisers. Like I'll run some Google ads to pay, you know, whatever I can to keep it going. But Josh was like, what if I just buy sneaker history and like that becomes our stuff? And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. You know, like, but that's really just me, you know, like none of my friends are a part of this other than like they on a whim, they'll write something. And so like that kind of turned into like, well, why don't I just write all this stuff? You know, like you need to build out like kind of a catalog of things to get the core sneaker stuff out there. But then it turned into like I'm writing, you know, copy on the site, copy on the app, like as we're developing that, all that kind of stuff. Take, you know, like basically he's like, you know, okay, come to Detroit after a month or two. Very similar where it was like, you know, you kind of knew that Detroit was the place that this was happening and it was a big part of StockX's story. And I went out there and, you know, like moved out there for a couple of years I was there. And I really love Detroit. It's going back to our conversation before we started recording, it's a very like sad element of capitalism that we see how we failed as America, how we failed this like genuinely beautiful, like interesting place. And
I think that Detroit is a very specific case of that, because it's not only there's only so much sort of natural rhythms that happen with these things, but Detroit specifically has been manipulated by their billionaire class into a boom and bust system so that the rich can sort of take over as much as possible there and then sort of manipulate it into enriching themselves. When you track that out on Detroit, when you track out their boom and bust cycle, and then just sort of like overlay with brackets who was the billionaire that was buying things up, it's a cycle. It's a very obvious cycle once you map it out. And it's very sad. Like you're saying that so many people are sort of on a roller coaster ride that they didn't sign up for. It's just their hometown and it's the place that they love. to the people that they love. And yet here's a few extraordinarily rich people just sort of like driving the whole ship.
Yeah, totally. That's so well put. Because what I loved about being there, you know, I went thinking, you know, I was sold the dream with StockX, just like everybody who joins. And not to say that it wasn't, you know, or isn't great for people. Like there, sure. You know, some people are looking for different things. I went thinking like, hey, I'm going to be able to establish, you know, maybe a home and, mm-hmm. you know, like have this life that supports me and whatever else comes for the next 10, say 20 years. Yeah. And it didn't work out in that sense. But like, you know, I met my girlfriend there early on. We've been together ever since, you know, going on 9 years now. So like, you know, like, wow, 10 years actually going on 10 years. So like, you know, like I can't complain about it at all. Like I've been, you know, like I'm happier in my life than I ever have been. And I wouldn't have had that had I not gone and said yes to that, which is an interesting other, you know, kind of mind fuck of like, man, like, you know, people see StockX and they think, oh, everybody that started StockX, you know, like by the time I went out there, checked it out, and then was convinced to move out there, like I was employee number 9. And like, you know, like nothing, there was no app that like, it was barely like launched in between me signing on full time and like being a consultant or a contractor or whatever. So it was such an interesting like experience, and I don't regret it in any way, but it was 100% not what I thought would come from it, you know?
Sure.
And the thing that I think I learned the most is kind of what you're alluding to with Detroit in general, right? Like there's so many interesting things for me about Detroit, how things have evolved there, the people, the development, the lack of development, you know, like the giant, you know, evil tower of Ford / GM looking over the city. And like, there's so many fascinating cultural things about Detroit to me. And I kind of fell in love with those aspects of it, not really thinking that that would be a thing. You know, like I'm very much spoiled in that, like, you know, growing up in California for the most part, I moved around a lot, but like always had family here. So like I would come back here to stay with my grandparents during the summers and stuff. I don't know. You're spoiled by good weather and you're kind of just mm-hmm. like, there's a lot of culture here. There's a lot of diversity here. There's just a lot of everything. And you can kind of find the things that interest you and challenge you. And going there was kind of like, I saw it and it's like, you know, I'm seeing all of the like scary headlines in the newspapers and stuff ahead of that. And like people can't survive. It's so cold. You know, people are literally freezing and, you know, freezing to death outside and all this crazy stuff. And I'm like, all right, well, like, I'm going to say yes, but like, mm-hmm. this seems wild and I'm just going to go for the ride. And like, I kind of say that to preface, like one of the things that like, just in talking to you today, realizing like how similar our journeys and just kind of being along for the ride of this, whatever this thing is, you know, it's not necessarily sneakers. It's not necessarily streetwear. It's not necessarily blog, you know, writing stuff. It's like this weird, beautiful combination of all these things that you and I have kind of like, maybe I'm gassing us up a little bit, but had the courage to say yes to be a part of, you know, like,
sure.
Because we're in this weird place where blogs are now almost coming back. Like somehow people like don't, you know, we went through like this era of like, let's build these giant stories around like these platforms. And then we went to like this moment of like, everybody cares about 2 seconds of a clip on
sure.
a different platform completely. And, you know, and I wonder like how you look at that in your journey, kind of looking back at like all the things you did, like what are some of those moments that are, you know, like you look back fondly on, you're excited about, you know, like I mentioned before we started recording, like I think I connected with you. The two stories that I know for sure I read when you first wrote them were there's a, and I don't know if this is like one of the first ones or you did a series on basically like being gay in the sneaker community. But like mm-hmm. I think I read either the second or third one, the one that
sure.
the one that you talked about Pride shoes. And I was like, yes, like how are we not celebrating? You know, like this is the problem with sneakers, which is what I'm mostly complaining about / writing about on Substack now is like we still haven't figured out how to just give people credit, how to celebrate people, how to mm-hmm. like have a decency within sneaker community or sneaker business. But then I also remember one that like you wrote about It was, I'm going to botch this, but basically like you can kind of just buy your way into sneakers, or you don't have to spend your way into sneakers. You can just be into sneakers. Like, you don't have to like know all these things to be into sneakers, you know, and which it resonated because like I love all, like, I collected and obsessed over all these different things. And then I started meeting the people behind sneakers and like sharing those stories. And it was like, ultimately, like, my favorite shoe is always going to be the Chuck Taylor, because it's the most universally accepted. Like, people can take it and make it their own. Like, that's the beauty of like self-expression with sneakers for me. Don't get me wrong, like, I have the fancy stuff and the love certain Jordan models and Reebok pumps and all that stuff. But like that story to me was so poignant to where I was coming from. I don't think people ever thought that about me, because I was always, like we were joking around about before, like, I was always like, here's the new release, here's the new colorway of this. And like, we got kind of pigeonholed into talking about the commercialized aspect of sneakers versus the, like, the identification that that people have with it, you know, like the self-expression of it, you know, like, and it's always been a part, but yeah, I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, so like, to answer sort of part of the beginning, it was when I started, my first job writing about sneakers was for Complex Sneakers. I was doing the daily news on the weekends, and you know, the edict from those folks, which included Matt Welty and Joe LaPuma and Gerard, that was like, the edict was to write an article every hour for those 7 or 8 hours that I was on call. And so when you have to write an article every hour, you're writing whatever you can get your hands on. Literally. And so it would be like, you know, there was a tease on Instagram about this shoe, or like, I got to the point where I had all these sort of like hyperlinks, or I guess just, you would just call them a link. I'm a millennial. And you would sort of like, I had the New Balance Korea store on link, because I knew that every couple of weeks I could go on the New Balance Korea store and there would be some wild shit there that nobody was seeing in the US. And I knew that nobody else was writing about this, and that I could just like type up 250, 350 words on that. But, and so I did that for a while. And then eventually Matt Welty came to me and he was like, would you write an article about what it means to be gay in the sneaker industry? And I was like, absolutely. Like, I have so much shit to say about this. I wrote it. I think that was my first like real piece that I wrote for Complex. It went live, and then a couple hours later, I got an email from Noah, from the editor-in-chief of Complex, who I hadn't spoken to at that point. And it was basically like I had gotten looped into a much longer conversation. And basically what I saw was, hey, Pete, the comments on your piece are horrific. People are saying horrible, homophobic, violent shit, but this is your piece. Should we turn the comments off or leave them on? And I said, I think you need to leave them on, because that's what I'm talking about in my piece, is that this culture is not, I don't want to say like accepting, but like, or the word tolerant, but like this culture is aggressively negative towards queer people. That's what my piece is about. And all you need for evidence is to scroll down, look at the comments.
Yep.
And they were like, yes, that's what we will do. We will respect that. And I think that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I came to sort of like the sneaker culture part of this much later. Even, I mean, it wasn't until after Kith, when I was writing for Complex, I sat down with a grid of all the Jordan, the game shoes, to really figure out what's the difference between a 6 and a 7, what's the difference between a 4 and a 5, so that I could identify them. Because at that point, I had no clue. You know, I knew what an Air Max 90 was. I knew what all the ASICs were, because I worked at Kith. But like, that was something that I had to sit down with. I was just really interested in the product. I didn't have the cultural background. And so as a result, all the pieces that I was writing and my perspective was not interested in this obsession with like the brand, or, oh, Michael Jordan. Like, I actually didn't care. about any of that. And so I was able to write these stories and bring these perspectives that were critical because I was sort of an interloper and was always going to be an interloper and was always going to feel that way because of my queerness. That's, you know, that's sort of like the experience of being queer is always being on the outside. And so I was able to recognize that. And I wrote a couple pieces in that guise. Like I wrote a piece on how to be a sneakerhead with $400, because all you need to do, they're all sort of cultural tokens. I think the essay that you're referring to, I think was titled something like the sneaker culture is the only culture that you can buy your way into. Because especially, I mean, it's less so the case now in February of 2026, but if you go back even just a couple of years, the number of like crypto bros who would buy a pair of Travis Scott Jordan 1 Lows, they would just buy that one pair and they would be like, I'm a sneakerhead. And there was a time where you could walk into a room with a pair of shoes like that and everybody else who called themselves a sneakerhead would be like, he's one of us. It didn't matter what else you had. It didn't matter what else you knew. It was that just one cultural signifier was all you needed. And I think that, and you know, that was before NFTs, and like the art world is like maybe similar, but it's really like, it really is one of the only cultures where people get away with knowing nothing. And I don't think you need to know a certain, you know, I don't think you need to have encyclopedic knowledge, but I think it's fascinating that it is there. The aesthetics is so important or foundational. And, you know, since the sneaker boom, you know, that started before COVID and then like just like really went crazy during COVID, our culture has become a lot more aesthetic where, you know, if you wear a red hat, that means something. That it didn't mean in 2015. And so, and like wearing a mask means something. It's more than just that person's health conscious. It has a cultural meaning. It has a political meaning. And I think sneakers was really like before now was really one of the only only cultures where that, you know, one piece of product spoke so much ahead of you before you even had to open your mouth.
Yeah, that's so well said. I think it's so fascinating, too, because hearing your perspective on that, not knowing you, not getting to know you and even talk to you really much outside of social until today. Like, I wonder if you think about this the same way, because I hear what you're saying and like your angle on this and your perspective on this and think, you're like the perfect person to like be a part of the story that we're collectively trying to push forward and share and introduce people to. And I think like we're in this weird place with editorial across the board where like there's just not enough. I mean, there's just not enough editorial out there. We're getting rid of anybody that speaks their truth and has an opinion. And I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but I think that's such an interesting, you know, like, and probably just why I resonated to the stuff that you were writing, where it's like, I'm getting to see another side of this. Not that I didn't see that type of stuff back then, but like to see that evolution. And honestly, like props to you for being that spokesperson in that moment and having the courage to say, leave those comments up. And I, you know, I'm glad that they let you make that decision, because you know, like you and I have both been part of teams where that editorial decision,
somebody else
is
makes
not,
a decision.
Not
yes.
us, you know?
Yes.
And I think that's important. And I, you know, and it's, you know, I don't know that I've seen that particular piece of yours. You know, maybe I should have gone and read more of the stuff that I didn't see in that time, but it was such a long time ago too, that I just was like, I just know these moments that I saw something that you did that I was like, oh, I gotta pay more attention to Pete. One of the things that you did, and I don't know where this fits in your, you know, career arc, story arc, but
sure.
You did a bunch of like cool video stuff with High Snobiety that
High
I thought
Snob,
was
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So well done early on, fun, casual. Like it was essentially what I think was successful for the individual or the independent YouTubers at the time, but you had a little more access, maybe. And I'm forgetting the names of the shows that you did, but there was at least two of them that you did where I was like, this could be like one, like if you did this on your own on YouTube and just ran with it, you'd probably find a ton of success in it, you know, but two, like, it's also cool that you have the access to the people that at that time, you know, I'm guessing this is like 10-ish years ago, YouTubers didn't quite have that access, right? You know, like you had to have high snob, you know, in the byline to get access to certain people. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because that's obviously evolved in a crazy way, you know, along with the sneaker evolution, the streetwear, and just like how big all of this stuff has kind of become.
Yes, Gian DeLean, who we all may know from.
Yeah.
I mean, I met him at Complex, and then he's now at Nordstrom. He like runs. I don't want to misrepresent him, but he is very high up there when it comes to what they're doing in the men's space. He was at High Snob, and he wanted to do a show that was sort of like Jim Cramer, but with sneakers. And this is when StockX was just sort of like getting their feet wet. And we started doing it before StockX was really established. The earlier episodes were just sort of like me reading the news and then writing episodes. But then eventually we paired with StockX and we did some live episodes with like the ticker on the bottom, whatever. Yeah. So Gian had me come in, and you know, I have a performance background, so I'm very comfortable on camera, and I'm a writer, so I could write these episodes. And so the first one was called Flips and Bricks, and we were talking about like what was coming, what's going to be good to resell, and what's not going to be good to resell. And that was sort of like good entry ways in to sort of also kind of talk shit sometimes and bring people in. But I think that Gian really wanted me to play a character, and I sort of didn't really want to go all the way into Jim Cramer. And so like, I totally get what he was going for, and it would have been hilarious, but it also was like, I was sort of busy and tired. And and so I don't think I went all the way that he wanted to go. And so that sort of to become a little bit more editorial. And then I guess they enjoy the editorial or something. They came to me and they're like, we're going to rebrand, and we want you to sort of just do what you would do given like the stories that you want to tell. And so we rebranded it into From the Ground Up. And there were, over the course of those, the two seasons that we did, I think there were two or three segments in all of those episodes that I didn't write. Everything else I wrote.
Wow.
We had great producers, Andrew Keegan, amazing. Kathy Steele, amazing. Dana, amazing. But part of it was, some of it was High Snob, but a lot of it was me just like texting people from the relationships that I had, that I had built, you know, whether, you know, the people at Jordan, people at other brands. And then eventually they started coming to us and saying like, we want to be on this. There are a number of celebrities came to us that I just like couldn't figure out how to work them in. So they never got in, but I sort of like, I'm sometimes too much of an editorial snob, because I was like, I don't know what to do with this B-list actor who's amazing, but like, they're not a sneaker person. I don't know what I'm going to talk about. But it ended up, I haven't checked recently, but for many years, it was their most watched show. And the problem that we got from the higher ups was they didn't like my haircut. I would get my producer, Andrew, who was like in charge of video at High Snob, and, you know, was the person that, you know, I was texting and emailing with him every day about what we were doing on the show. Every now and then, when the owner of High Snob would sort of like be sufficiently angry enough, Andrew would be like, I have to talk to you about your haircut. You can keep your haircut, but it's my job to sort of like relay the feedback from the executive team. And I was like, if you guys are not going to pay me a lot more, this haircut is sort of signature to my online persona. And it was like, you would go, it's probably still there, you would go and look at these episodes, and the top comment would be like, this guy's fucking haircut is ridiculous. Never mind that then Maluma's stylist put the haircut on Maluma, and now like you see it everywhere. Celebrities wear it everywhere. But for a long time, it was just me and my barber, who initially refused to give me that haircut. I photoshopped a thing, and he's like, I'm not letting anybody walk out of the barbershop with this haircut. And I was like, okay, I'll leave. And he was like, really? And I was like, yeah, I want this haircut.
That is so amazing.
Eventually, I think the guy, I'm not going to name check him, but the guy who owned High Snob eventually was like, I can't deal with this guy and his haircut anymore, which, like, you know, that's up to you. but none of their shows performed as well for a very long time. And yeah, you know, we got to do a lot of really cool things. We got to go into places. I got to have hard conversations with people. And it was also a platform where, like, we had a whole episode dedicated to women in the sneaker space, which at the time, I mean, Jordan Brand had only just launched their women's division. And we got to, you know, I got to bring Andrea on because I had met her through interviewing her for other things. And she was the GM of Jordan Women's at the time. Now, she went to PlayStation. I don't know what she's doing right now. But, it was a great opportunity. We were going to have 20 minutes a week to talk about the sneaker industry. And there's only so many articles that people can write about Jordan Brand's lie about what bread and what band means. And, you know, so you get to a point where, and I get really tired of these fucking stories, the same fucking stories, season after season after season. And I understand why, you know, people want to continue writing about the pigeon dunk. Like, I understand why that's an interesting story, but there's also, it's been written 150 times. Yeah. And so, like, I don't want to write that story because somebody else has already done it. I want to do something that is the thing that people aren't talking about, the thing that people are talking around, which, like, there's a conversation to be had about, like, why aren't Jordan's shoes cool? Like, why aren't they... Yep. Why aren't they releasing good shoes? That's a good question. And, you know, there may not be an answer to it. And it may mean that, like, your PR person at Jordan Brand is going to be really unhappy about that. And you might not get the shoes for 6 months or 12 months or never get another pair of shoes again, like happened with me with New Balance when I asked them why they were supporting Donald Trump. They never spoke to me again. And I understand. Yep. But it's also like, if you're not willing to sort of tell the truth about yourself and your own experience in these places, then you will continue to get the access. But the access, because they're trying to tell a story, is always going to be limited. And people are busy. And so, of course, they're going to try to ask you to write the band story again. Like, of course, I get it. But, and there are people who will read it. I will not be one of those people because I know that story, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think that's like the, I don't want to say like the nail in the coffin for sneakers, but it's so the start of the hammering, right? It is so problematic. And, you know, admittedly, you know, I've been a part of that problem. Like, I've had to tell those stories multiple times through the years, you know, like it's,
yeah,
you know, I want to come back to the access conversation, but part of what you talked about made me think about, like, there's this really interesting thing that I think a lot of people don't understand when they maybe see something that someone like you or I wrote or created under this other banner or brand or whatever. The haircut thing is a hilarious, like, I hope you wear that with pride because that is absolutely amazing. And when you write your biography, wherever it lands and whenever it lands, that is going to be like, I'm going to read that again and laugh so hard because it is so poignant in like the just disconnectedness of the way some of these companies work. And not all of them are. And sometimes, as we were talking about before we started recording, sometimes you've got great people fighting for those things to not happen. And ultimately they have to make the decision to share that information with you. Or sometimes they're even, you know, forced to, you know, say that enough is enough with whatever those things are. But one thing that's kind of is interesting about like hearing your, you know, the experience with High Snob, with the video stuff, you know, like with Complex, you know, I was not a part of the decision making for keeping Complex as Complex TV, right? But when we started Quick Strike, you know, it was very limited as to like where it could go and how it could grow because we were trying to push this Complex TV experience. We were completely like, we're going to do our own thing as Complex. We're not going to participate in YouTube. We're bigger than that. Part of what I think ends up happening with a lot of these companies is like that mentality. And you, I'm not saying that it's right or wrong, because I think like it's really nuanced as to like how a decision maker or an executive decides on that. because you're also coming from, if you think of like the places that you mentioned that you've written for, those are massive brands. And at the time, you know, most everyone that's on YouTube is, you know, unboxing some shoes or showing you how to roll your jeans or, you know, like it's so basic stuff. And I love all those people.
Yeah.
They're like friends, you know, like I think about
GT
like,
fan.
Yeah.
Shout like, out to Cody.
Yeah. Cody, man. Like, I mean, Cody and Jacques and, I mean, Eddie Wynn and Yoanti and all these guys that like, they just did it. Just, they did it and they didn't stop. I mean, I know I mentioned Yoanti and he's kind of long removed from it now, but like I had so much respect for them because I was like, look, it takes a lot to do that back then. You know, like you weren't just, you know, you had to figure out how to make those videos back then. And like you said, you had a great production team with you with High Snob. And what's really interesting is that you guys were creating that Jim Cramer style thing, the early iterations of it. I didn't realize that that show, I thought, I didn't watch every show. I thought that those were two separate shows that ran parallel. And I was like, man, how is this guy knocking out two shows in like my head? But I guess like I do remember the kind of evolution and like the after the Flips and Bricks, like it kind of maybe up. You might have leveled up the production a little bit, yeah. Too, like I think. But it's funny because at that time at StockX, Josh wanted to do a Mad Money style thing, right? So we're like, the funniest thing about sneakers and like, you know, just creative culture in general is like we all think we're in these like unique places and we think that people take our ideas, but we all consume 90% of the same content. We know, yeah. 90% of the same people, and then we all are trying to put out something that's very similar. And what's funny is like works out, you know, I think it all works out the way it's meant to, right? But it's like your experience in like building that with High Snob and running into the challenges. When we started that with StockX, you know, Josh and I have had like ups and downs in our relationship for the whole time we've known each other. Not like extremes in any way, but it's just like I think we're both very opinionated about things. We're very critical of ourselves and of like what we want to put out there to the world. So like when we did that first one, the desk was built out and he kind of like does what I do, like, and this is why I never wanted to be on camera, because I like use my hands all the time, like it's, you know, let me get rid of some of these nerves as I'm talking. And for Josh, like that first episode came out and he was using his hands a ton. And he didn't want to edit it down, but like then the second episode or the third episode, he came back with the giant gloves and like made fun of himself with it. And it was like, I don't know if it landed the way it should have, or if it even if we just didn't have the right push to get it out there to the levels that we wanted to at the beginning. But it's so funny because even before we started that, we talked about having, you know, a co-host, someone like you. I don't know if he was talking to you directly at that. I mean, I don't know if he had mentioned it to you before we started that, but it's like, we knew that like, we didn't want it to be like this thing where he was the sole, sure. You know, we didn't want him to be the linchpin or the bottleneck in the whole system because,
yeah.
You know, he's running the company at that time. So like, it was this ongoing conversation, but like similar to what you were saying with like, okay, people, we've got people that are opinionated about it above, that are saying this has got to happen. We've got all the things we want to do that, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, the ticker stuff, like at the time was like, okay, well, like, is this going to be a real ticker or are we just going to fake it? You know, like all those things where like the technology is just not the same. We originally were like, could this be like a show that we do like as a live stream? And like, can we just tell people to tune in at this time every day versus just uploading at that time every week or whatever, yeah. It was. But it's so interesting to hear how similar your experiences with like just the challenges of it, the inputs that people don't see that ultimately shape and almost always result in the shows kind of disappearing for no reason other than like, you know, like I think that any of those given the, let's say, budget or, you know, manpower could be successful YouTube shows, you know, like I was at Complex when they started First We Feast, right? So like Chris Schoenberger and, you know, Sean, and like seeing that grow is like, this is the perfect example of how to make it work in all these nuanced ways, you know, and like nothing we did at StockX or at Quickstrike had like the wings is like the thing that's like, I got to watch my favorite celebrity suffer through this kind of thing. But it's so interesting that like the formula is so similar across all these different editorial platforms and channels or whatnot. But yet we're still running into the same issues and the same challenges.
So this sort of like, this touches against something that I'm currently dealing with, which is that any sort of conversation around sneakers and the sneaker industry is inherently woven together, inseparable from consumerism. And I have a lot of feelings right now about the ethics of me talking about and pushing, ultimately pushing people towards a purchase. Mm-hmm. Because that's a lot, like, that's what the stories are. It's ultimately about a product that is meant to be bought and sold. You look at First We Feast, which I wrote a number of articles for them as well. It's a lot of it is not about read about this thing and now go buy it. It's like, what are the best wings? Or one of the articles I wrote for First We Feast was, what's the best chicken sandwich in New York right now with these three companies? Or you look at Sean's show, and that's the point of that is so that so you go see that celebrity's movie, or you watch mm-hmm. their show, or you buy their book or whatever. But that's not what the content is, right? And so I'm trying to figure out, like, there are certain stories that I want to talk about when it comes to sneakers or sweaters or streetwear, any of that. But I'm so used to historically from what I wrote on Complex, especially with the news, but also everything else, that a lot of times at the bottom of the article would be a button that says, hey, now, you know, mm-hmm. and especially at a time when, I mean, to say nothing about how shitty the economy is right now, to say nothing about the transfer of wealth, it's like, where is the ethics here? And I think that's a question that people who are writing and talking about sneakers and streetwear have to ask that question, specifically in ways that people that talk about food, that talk about, I mean, mm-hmm. in some ways politics, that talk about art, that talk about even like film and books, because those things are much more easy to get access to. You can go to the library, you can get something on streaming, and like the most you'll pay is $15 for a ticket or $30 for a book. And then it's also like, do you want to, what's the value of talking about how great of a shoe is if you don't get access to it? That was something that I always was like, why are we talking? Why is there an article about this pair of shoes that Michael Jordan's son is wearing? Why is it an article that Kamala Harris's nephew is wearing Dior Jordans at the inauguration? Like, they're rich. Of course they have access to that. That's not a story. That's not interesting. And so I'm trying to figure out for myself, like, what can I write about that is not ultimately an advertorial or just an advertisement, because I know I'm not getting paid for it.
Yeah.
While at the same time, so much of our audience is primed and interested and hungry in that. So I know that they'll click on it. I know that that will get eyes. I know that that will get traffic, and maybe somebody will turn into a paid subscriber or something. And I would like that so that I can go, you know, buy a sandwich. But I don't think it's necessarily ethically clean. And so I always find myself sort of moving towards, even though writing those articles would be the easiest and they're the most natural for me because I've written so many articles like that, I find myself not writing about it because I'm like, this is just, I'm just writing a free advertisement for a company that doesn't give a shit about me or them. And if those shoes don't sell, regardless of whether or not they're good, they're making a good statement, it's good for the industry, it's a high quality product, if it doesn't sell, they're just going to stop making it because it's not profitable.
Yeah.
And so it's like, am I part of this machine or am I not?
Yep. Yeah. It's so interesting because I, you know, like I've said before we started recording, I've been struggling to find what that purpose is for me again.
Yeah.
You know, going from, you know, I'm so grateful for the experiences I've had, and I'm very aware, you know, how consumer driven all of that stuff, you know, my entire career doesn't exist, you know, like I don't get to write about other things unless the entire sneaker industry has the growth that it had,
right,
in, you know, 2000s, 2012 or whatever it was. And even beyond that, you know, like StockX wouldn't. I've been on this ride for a long time now, I guess. But like, it's really interesting to think about. And I have that same back and forth internally of like wanting to see, and I'm sure for you, like wanting to see some of your friends that are still a part of it, you know, still be employed and still get to do those things and go. But like, I have no desire to, you know, go to the Super Bowl and like interview somebody that doesn't have an interest in the product that they're essentially selling. And so that's been an interesting part of like me rediscovering Substack, which like people know my opinion. I think all of these platforms are like, you can make something for yourself out of them, but I think they're all evil inherently. Sure. But, you know, maybe right now Substack to me is the least of the evils, and it's like giving me a way to reconnect with people or connect with new people, I guess, that don't necessarily, you know, have the same, they're looking for something different if they're on Substack, it feels like. I don't know how long that will last, you know. Sure. Like maybe one day, you know, that turns into like we were talking about before, maybe one day I'm back to like blogging on my own site again about just things I find interesting, you know, because I love that when I find somebody that, you know, has a perspective or a sense of style around something. You know, there's so many examples of people that we looked at, you know, probably 20 years ago, and it's like, man, they just continued to do it. And now it's like maybe they're connected to a magazine or maybe they're not, but like there's just really interesting people in the world, and like trying to find them is challenging with social media. But maybe we're circling back to a place where, you know, that is more personalized and less about all of the consumer click, you know. I can't imagine that, but I'm going to say it optimistically. But like, you know, like maybe it's something that we circle back to where there's a value behind it.
Yeah.
What's interesting, there's two things that I had as you were saying that. At the beginning of the pandemic, maybe just a little bit before, like I was still working for was finished. I can't remember when I left StockX. So you worked under Dana. Mm-hmm. Like Dana is like friends with like one of my like best friends in the world. We didn't know each other until we knew Julie. Sure. Until like she came to Detroit, and I was like, oh my God, like this is great. Of course, like, you know, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole because there was obviously things that like with Josh and I that were just not going to work in the way that the company was going. Dana was kind of like, look, you know, this just is probably not happening the way you want it to in any time in the future. And I'm so grateful that she was like truthful with me about that. You know, I have lots of thoughts on that. I'm going to cut myself off there, but like basically, you know, like the, trying to gather my thoughts here, the experience of like StockX for me kind of left a, you know, bad taste in my mouth with sure. sneakers. Not the friends, like there's so many things where like you find that right thing that you share something that you're excited about, your sweater, your whatever, like, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, like that's what I want to talk to people and understand what they're passionate about so I can go discover something that's completely new and interesting to me based on somebody else's wow factor. You know, like if they see the wow factor in it, then I got to look at it and see like friend of mine, Rick, I'm going to get him on this show sometime soon, just sent me a knife. I have no interest in knives at mm-hmm. all. Never even thought of them. The details on this thing are fucking insane. And I'm like, I literally text him like, Rick, I can't afford to buy these things, man. Like, don't send me these things. This is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of the thing. And so I, during that time frame of like kind of being like, okay, I need to like look at sneakers and think about like, what am I doing here? Like what, you know, like what am I really trying to do here? And then of course the pandemic hit, and it was like, okay, I was doing a bunch of consulting work, had a handful of clients, and then all of a sudden it's gone. And we had been doing this sneaker history podcast for maybe 6 months or a year. And that first 6 months of the pandemic, so many people reached out and were like, thank you for just giving me something to be distracted with and being and not talking about all the shitty things. Like, it was like, you're my hour or two a week of like, my brain doesn't have to think about all the terrible things in the world. And I had never ever thought of myself being that, because I'm always looking for that, trying to find my podcast or show to be like, I'm just going to zone out. And at least for this 2 hours, nothing else is going to matter, you know? And so like that shifted a lot of the way I thought about what I was putting out there. And not that I wasn't going to put stuff out, because I just like creating, but it was such an interesting like struggle for me to like, or you know, like, not a struggle, that's not the right word, but like that shift was so mentally like something I had to grasp onto and lean into and like really listen to internally for so long, because it was like, you know, yes, there's value in me just having conversations with people, but like now people are actually saying that they're looking to me for some escape, and it's like, whoa, like I know tons of people have read some of the stuff that I've done prior to that. I know millions of people have read things that have been posted. And yet that was like the first really poignant, like powerful moment of like, oh, people want to just hear this as a distraction from the rest of things, good or bad. You know, like nowadays I think I don't want to be your distraction. Look at us, like we need to fix this. But
sure,
there's a whole other topic for the show. But I say that to say like Substack, coming back around, like has been an interesting experience for me, because I'm super critical about things. I'm super, you know, and sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm optimistic. I want to see, I can't remember which story we kind of reconnected over, but you know, like I'm not coming at this from like a releases. I'm not talking about new stuff just to talk about new stuff. Like, you know, I struggle to balance me wanting to just speak what I'm thinking and feeling and, you know, experiencing to like, also me having, you know, almost 20 years or so of experience within the corporate world of doing this stuff, the polished stuff. And like, that's a really interesting kind of place to be with Substack, which, and like with your writing, I'm really curious, like how you look at that now with all of your experience too, because that perspective has probably changed for you over the years as to like what, you know, whether that's the consumer side or whatnot, but like, How much of the, I guess like I'm botching my words so bad right now.
You're fine.
Your experience in working for other companies versus like, you know, what you do writing wise on your own. Like, how do you look at that now with all of the experience you've had versus the way you, you know, previously thought of doing that? We both talked a little bit about before, but like, just like even the nature of like, finding work and doing things is so different now than what it was, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago.
Well, what I can tell you with my experience, what I can tell you about what I'm doing is I'm doing a really bad job, because if I were in charge, like if I were my own boss, which I technically am, I would have to sit myself down and be like, what's your beat? Like, what are you writing about? What's the cadence? What's the length? Who's your audience? Because if you were to go to my Substack right now, you would be like, when is this guy publishing? What's his publishing date? What's his publishing, you know, how many a week, how many a month? And then what's the topics? Because if you go through all my stuff, it's all different stuff. It's all different shit. And even the title, I think about this all the time. The title of my Substack is Okay So, because whenever a lot of times people in my life will come to me and be like, Pete, can you explain whatever? And I'm like, okay, so, and then, and it, that's just like one of my sort of verbal tics. So that's what it's about, because it's not about sneakers. It's not about books. It's not about what's happening politically, but all those things sort of like come through, because for me, it's all the same. It's all just sort of like what I'm processing. But in terms of packaging a product, it doesn't work. I can't say, you know, the title of your Substack should trigger people to know what they're going to get, so that they know. And that's what you've done so successfully. I think that's a big part of why your Substack has grown so strongly, because even just the title, people know what they're going to get from you. Whereas for me, like if you read my piece about what everybody got wrong about Stephen King's Carrie, and then the next thing you see is here's why this pair of clerks means so much to me, you're not going to keep coming back because you don't know what it's going to be. So my own experience teaches me that what I'm doing is wrong. That being said, I think that I have a certain amount of fortune coming from art school in that so much of that conversation, the question of, you know, what is the function of art and art for art's sake is very much like a first semester conversation of art school, because I was lucky enough that I left there. I graduated without any student loans, but a lot of people took on a lot of student loans, leaving with six figures in student loans. And the probability, I went to acting school, the probability of you making that money back and being able to pay that money back in the theater or film and television is, I mean, like less than 0.5%. So at some point you need to recognize that the work is inherently valuable, that this conversation is inherently valuable. If it's going to get, and I graduated from school before there was any likes of any kind. You could poke mm-hmm. people on Facebook, but that was it. And so like you would maybe get a review and you could judge based on ticket sales. But otherwise, there wasn't like I'm going to put this thing into the world and within seconds, I'm going to know if people like this or not. And inherently, a part of that, you start directing towards or away from certain things so that you can get the likes, so you can get the shares, so you can get the subscribers. The problem with that is that involves censorship and it directs self-censorship. It directs the conversation in ways that are not necessarily interesting. You know, H.P. Lovecraft, racist, anti-Semitic asshole, but he has shaped so much about the way that we think about sci-fi and horror, and he mm-hmm. died penniless in his 40s. Sorry, not in his 40s. It wasn't until the 40s, decades after he finished writing, that other people found his work and started, and now I have this huge tome of Lovecraft because I'm writing some stuff about Lovecraft. You know, and it's what's his name, Van Gogh, who sold one painting while he was alive. It's, you have to, and that's part of it. I mean, Van Gogh was incredibly depressed. He famously cut off parts of his body, but he was interested in, he applied himself to that study, to that interest. And then the question comes in, you know, art for art's sake, but I'm talking about shoes. So let's be serious. Like, let's not pretend that like writing about this pair of Clarks is going to be sort of like what opens somebody's mind into the divine. And so it's this constant sort of balance. But for me, what I'm always trying to remind myself when I see that, like, oh, this piece got 8 views, 8 people clicked on this, then I ask myself, well, if I didn't write this, would it still be sitting in me? Would I still want to write it? And the answer is yes. And so whether it's a journal entry for me or somebody else finds it. I mean, I bring up the thing about Carrie because I wrote this piece about Carrie, more than a year or probably around a year ago. And only last week or the week before somebody commented on it saying, I have been looking for somebody to talk about Carrie, but they're all talking about sort of like synopses and whatever. This is the analysis that I wanted. And that's not to say that like, if one person gets something from this, it means it's all been worth it. No, like maybe it's not worth it because I spent all those hours and whatever.
Yeah.
But there are so many, I mean, in the last 10 minutes of this conversation, you said things that are that appear in 3 drafts that I have for stuff that's on Substack. There are stories that I wanted to write like a year ago. There's drafts that I started 18 months ago that if I had published at that time, I would be able to be sharing right now. There's this whole story that I want to talk about sort of like decentering yourself as an audience member. And for me, it was decentering my whiteness when going to go see Black Panther. And in that lesson has allowed me to sort of enjoy things that I otherwise might have been critical about or worried about being critical about. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like Bad Bunny is not my favorite artist, but I've relieved myself from needing to determine whether or not he's going to be good or bad. And then I can just enjoy it. And I see so many people worried about what's my opinion going to be on Bad Bunny that like actually that stops you from enjoying it. And if I had published this piece a year ago, 2 years ago, when I first started working on it, I would be able to sort of like keep pointing back to this and like maybe that would find me more readers and more. But like the process is the process. You do what you can do. And ultimately, like, it's about the work. It's always about the work. And you know, you can position yourself towards audiences and that can work sometimes. There's this Jim Carrey story that I think about all the time, that when it was a relatively early interview with him. He was on one of the late night shows. I don't remember who it was, but he was talking about how the lesson that he got from his father is that you can fail even at the things that you don't want. You can fail at the safe thing, because his father wanted to be an artist, recognized that being an artist was like not, you know, that didn't make sense financially. So he pursued a more conventional career, and still that career didn't work out. And so he was penniless and, you know, upset about not doing that. And so Jim Carrey said, I'm going to go all in on this acting thing because I could fail at anything. Nothing is promised. So you have to just do the thing. You have to do the thing.
Yep. That's so, so poignant too, because, you know,
I'm not hearing
being so you. Committed to sneakers.
Might have dropped.
Oh, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Uh-oh. Can you hear me now? Can you see me? Can you see me?
Now it just came back.
Okay, cool.
It's been out for like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, all good. All good. I was going to say that's so poignant. One, I just saw not the interview from the late night stuff, but I literally like 2 days ago watched Jim Carrey give a commencement speech and he tells that story. And like it hit so hard with me because part of what it's so funny because you were like, I appreciate that you were like saying that I'm finding success with the Substack. I'm also looking at my Substack thinking I'm fucking writing about sneakers still. So like, on the flip side, I'm looking at like the freedom that you have to write about multiple things and not have a schedule and like, and I'm you know, this is like, I think just the struggle of wanting to write and the struggle of how business works and how how people consume things and how people want, you know, people show up at Tuesday at 6 p.m. to watch whatever that show is and read whatever that thing is. And they read the Times or whatever, you know, every Sunday, because that's what they do. And I struggle, like, I don't want that, but I'm trying to force myself to commit to that. And sneakers is kind of the best way for me to do that right now, especially in a sense that, like, I can look at sneakers and people know I haven't bought a pair of shoes in a year and a half. You know, I'm not opposed to it, but it's not a priority for me. Like, I still love seeing the new stuff. I still love going into the stores and like seeing stuff that, especially that friends worked on, or seeing the campaigns that some of the brands do, where I just get excited because I'm like, oh, I know the people that are getting to like tell that story. But also, like, I'm talking about sneakers in a way that's much more critical than I've ever been. You know, like, I am not thinking about like, is Nike going to hire me? Mm-hmm. It's more like, Nike needs to get their shit together and step up. And like, you know, like, we've seen equality. We've seen, you know, Black Lives Matter across the T's. We've seen all of these things that you claim you're about. But like, guess what? All those people are being attacked right now. So where are you at? You know, like, and I've gotten a lot of feedback that is great for me personally to be like, yeah, keep speaking your truth and all that. And I'm so thankful for it. But at the same time, like, in my mind, I'm like, here I am, like, still talking about sneakers, you know, like, to your point, like, I don't have a buy it now button at the bottom of the Substack, which is, I guess, the best part about Substack for me right now. But it's such an interesting, you know, it's an interesting place. And like, for me, like, I kind of got to the point where I wasn't writing for, you know, almost a, I mean, I write every day now. And for most of my life, I've written every day since about eighth grade, whether that's, you know, a couple hundred words in a journal or there are times where I've been like, I'm going to commit to 500 words a day, even if it never gets published, it'll just live someplace for me. And I kind of like went into this dark space between like, you know, losing my grandparents, losing my job, and then losing my mom at the beginning of this year over the course of this like last 3 years, where I was like, okay, writing is just not, it's not happening. Trying to embrace that, that like this is, you know, maybe what it's supposed to be. But also like, I just want to express all the thoughts that I'm having at the same time. And so it's been really interesting for me to go through that part of it, looking at, you know, whether it's Substack or other people's, you know, writing on, you know, let's say Esquire or GQ or, you know, just anywhere where you're reading somebody's stuff. It is such a, it's such a challenge for me to commit to it the way that I have been. It's been successful, air quotes, if, you know, for people that are listening, because like for the first time ever, I'm actually making just a tiny bit of money and I don't have anybody telling me not to say something.
Sure.
I've never been able to write and get paid without somebody saying you can't say that.
Sure.
I also probably have way more typos, way more run-on sentences, terrible punctuation like than I've ever had, because aside from, you know, Cam being my editor in chief over here, you know, like it's kind of an interesting place to be with the writing, because I do feel like I'm doing the work, but I feel like I'm doing the work that's not the work that I really love about the writing in a lot of ways, because it's like I'm having to be the taskmaster for myself to get the post out. And my thing is I'm committing to this year for whatever this becomes. And if it becomes that this pays for, you know, a couple of meals a month and that's it, so be it. If it becomes something that I can, you know, pay my rent with, then I will happily take that. But I always end up finding, I always find myself in that place of like wanting to talk about so much more. And it's really interesting to hear you being like, kind of like talking about the things that I already think when I'm not focused on the sneaker thing over here as this newsletter. Like that's how my mind works. I probably have hundreds of drafts in my WordPress that I could look at and be like, whoa, I was feeling some type of way on that day when I started that. And some of it's interesting to go back to. And like, I wonder how you think about this with your drafts. Like part of me is like really fascinated by just the psychology of that for me as an individual. But part of me is also like really interested in, and I don't think I'm doing this anytime soon, but I'm interested in like sharing that as well. Like the unfinished drafts are really fascinating to me. Like, you know, and I think like we do this and you know, your art school background is kind of an example of this, right? Like, or there's examples of this where we, you know, if we didn't see all of the work in progress from Da Vinci, would we think, like we would think differently of him as an individual? Maybe he's a bad example because he seems to be fairly incredible, but like the amount of incredibleness that we see in him, like is a result of seeing so many unfinished projects and unfinished paintings and ideas and the drafts, right? Like the drafts are like, we're so lucky as human beings to be able to see the drafts of someone like that. And I start to think about that with all the other people that have had similar experiences, and especially with the internet, right? Like, I mean, just, I'm not saying that everyone should post their like Instagram drafts or whatever, or their TikTok drafts or whatever, but like, there's a really interesting psychological aspect to that that I am thinking about a lot lately. And it's interesting that you brought that up.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of this conversation that I had at StockX with one of my writers there. It was pretty early on, and Nick Matthews, he was writing about, I don't remember what he was writing about. It might have been, he'll be mad about this, but he was writing an article that basically said the reason that Supreme is popular is because of Tyler, the Creator. And I was like, you're wrong, but I'm happy to hear the argument. And he wrote this long piece that sort of, it wasn't to my standards in terms of a constructed argument that made the case. It had a lot of like points along the map, but I didn't see the causation. And the more I sort of pressed him to show the cause, the sort of more unruly it became. And then I asked him to just take smaller bites. And no one had ever said that phrase to me. It just sort of like came out of the ether. And it's really been something that I've been sort of playing with on Substack, which is to really think about the size of the bite that I'm taking. Because a lot of what I'm interested in that sort of spurs essays and articles are really too big, especially because I've spent the last couple of years since I got let go at StockX, I've been writing books, which are very big bites. Yeah. And, but that's not what you want to put on Substack. And before this, I was taking really small bites because of those articles that I was writing for Complex and the work that I was doing for Esquire, like, would mostly cap out at 1500 words, but then the books that I'm writing, the drafts are, you know, around 100,000. So they're much bigger sort of narrative thoughts. And so I'm trying to find a space between 1,000-1,500 words. And I'm finding that my drafts are somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 words, which I think is fine because, you know, it's sort of like, comes together. And as a part of my training and my artistic process, for me, I'm always waiting for the piece to show me what it wants to be. I'm not the director, right? I type out every sort of thought that I have, congruous, incongruous, whatever. I give it some space. I come back to it. I do the George Saunders thing. And then eventually, like, I sit down and it all sort of like aligns itself. And the bottom half always is able to get cut off. And then it's just refined, refined, refined.
Interesting.
And so it's, I find myself somewhere around page 5 when I'm like, isn't this supposed to just be a story about me going to go see Black Panther? That I'm realizing I'm taking bites that are too big. These bites are too big. And, you know, the first time that I wrote for Esquire, which was the first time I was invited on a press trip, they needed somebody, I guess that they had lost a writer or something, and they needed somebody to go to Portland for the Jordan 31. And Jonathan reached out, I think, to Gian and was like, I need a writer. Who would it be? And Gian suggested me. I think that's the way that it went. And they sent me to Portland, and it, you know, it was 3 1-hour interviews. One of them was on background. And I walked out of those 3 hours being on campus, and there were 6 stories. I was like, I have 6 stories here. And I reached out to Jonathan and I was like, I have 6 stories. And he was like, great, let's take the 6 stories, because I wasn't going to put them all in one piece, because first of all, like, a piece didn't have the strength to hold all those ideas. Mm-hmm. But also it was like, let's let each idea be its own thing. And I think that's a, I don't want to say a balance, but that's something that we all need to sort of navigate, is what's the size of the bite that I'm taking. And it's unique to our audiences and it's unique to our writers, you know? I think about when writers who I know that I like that write really big books, every now and then they'll come out with a short book, and it's like, this is not good, because this writer is better at big thoughts, you know? And somebody who writes short books comes out with a long one, and you're like, this is 3 books, you know? And part of that's a function of the writer, and part of that's a function of me as the reader expecting a certain thing from that person. And so when I see somebody's name come up who like was really good on Twitter, and so they're really good at the 140 characters, and I see that they've written an essay, I'm not going to read that essay, because that's not what I want from them. And that's a me problem.
Yeah.
But so that's what I'm trying to figure out, is like, I do have these thoughts. I do have these bites that are what I would consider too big for an audience on Substack, just because like I know my own writing style. I know I have a tendency to like riff. I know I have a tendency to go on tangents that don't that are fascinating to me, but not necessarily to anybody else. But if it's that fascinating, write another piece about it.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. I mean, I'm super long-winded when it comes to things because I just follow the trail in my mind down to whatever that level, granular level is. And, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it's, you know, absolute chaos. You know, it's just a really interesting. It's funny because like I've assumed that our conversation would be as good as it's been today, but we haven't talked about like anything that I thought we would talk about.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating about that and like what you just said, too, that I don't think that, you know, I don't think that we realize on a ongoing basis how like that bite size is so important into how we come across out there. Right. Like, you know, like you mentioning Twitter, it's like there's so many people that I like I haven't been on Twitter and. You know, like I posted because a friend was like, you just need to post that on Twitter and it'll go, you know, I was like, okay, so I've posted a couple of things, but I hate being on Twitter. I've deleted it. Like, and I'm just like, I don't want to support this shit. I don't want to support any of it. And then it's like, well, how do I get people to find me over here? And like that thought process in itself is problematic for me.
Right.
Cause I'm like, I don't want to be thinking that way. But then like when I'm having conversations with friends and they're like, yeah, just do it. Just, you know, like, it's like, okay, well I'll, you know, like, but I'm like not on there. Right. And, but I miss so many of the people from like 10, 12 years ago that just were witty. The banter was good. It challenged my thoughts. Like there was so much about it that was like the town square of the internet kind of vibe where it's just like, what the fuck are those people doing?
Yeah.
Okay. That's really, I need to look at that. But then like, to your point, like, you know, the person that's good at that doesn't necessarily mean that they're good at writing a, you know, 300 words or 1,000 words or a book. It's really interesting. Cause like we think of it as society, we're programmed to think of it as like, everybody should do all of these things. Right. And I have to catch myself in a lot of ways. Like I wrote about the Bad Bunny stuff, the performance. Cause I'm like, I just am excited that, like, one, I've barely watched. I grew up as like a football fan because my family, you know, it's a sports family, right? 49ers. Like, there's a lot of reasons why I became a fan of football. But then when the Kaepernick stuff happened, I literally stopped watching football altogether because I'm like, I don't want to support this shit. Like, it's already bad enough. There's so many reasons not to support this sport. And then like slowly, like it found its way back in and like friends would be like, oh, like we're having this get together and like whatever. I don't watch it the way I used to. Like I just am not interested in it. But I've watched like seeing Kendrick was I'm a huge hip hop fan. I got to work with Kendrick when he first signed with Reebok. Like I'm like a huge fan of him as a human being. Maybe not as deep in the religious aspects that he goes, but like I'm like a huge fan of him breaking generational trauma is like the most beautiful, fascinating example that I can see right now. And Bad Bunny speaking his truth, you know, like there's so much where like, I'm like, can we just commit to doing this every early February where someone gets the platform to fucking say what needs to be said and shine a light on their people? And like, it should just never be the normal ass cis white guys like that we have running the country right now that are, I don't go too far down that, but like that's been so cool to see. So like, I got a little long winded about the Bad Bunny thing because Adidas as a brand didn't post anything about him being performing. Like I want brands to be, if they get the benefits of being a human being behind the scenes in the taxes, then at least for God's sake, fucking retweet or repost or support the initiatives that your people that you're making money off of are doing. And I know that that is in today's world, that is not how it works. But like, I've also found like a lot of like drive to continue to have that conversation through my Substack, which is really interesting. And I got a lot of positive feedback, you know, like I got a lot of people reaching out about that piece in particular and just being like, you know, like, keep going with it. And like, let's have some more conversations. I'm going to have a couple of people on this show to talk about it. You know, like, it's really kind of interesting because it is like way too big of a bite for me. Like, I just know that, like, if I can get, you know, 1,100, 1,200 people to subscribe to a Substack, then I can use that platform to get other people to share that platform with me and share these messages and have these conversations and hopefully break this new trauma that you like introduced me to. That sounds weird, but like our previous conversation about the trauma of like where we're at in society after COVID, you know, it's like, I've always wanted to do this stuff. Like we've tried to do, you know, I don't need to get into that, but like, we've tried to do that for years in different ways. You've done a really great job of that. And like, ultimately it's always going to be a fight because the billionaires control all of this stuff. But it's really fascinating to hear you like break that down into like taking the bite is such a beautiful analogy of like how we have to like choose our battles. Because I wake up like needing to write, and I'm guess positioning this to ask you like how you look at this. I wake up needing to write. I'm very much a fighter when it comes to like my people, my friends, my family, the people that are like being attacked, being oppressed. I'm like the like I feel like I need to use my voice in whatever that is. And if it's sneakers, that's my vessel that gets people to pay the fuck attention and wake up, then so be it. It's really hard for me to think of it that way because like using sneakers as a conduit for anything that's this big of importance is stupid. You know, when I step back and think about it, you know, it's like, but also some people would never see the things that I'm trying to express without that. So I have to like keep my monkey mind in check, so to speak, a lot.
Yeah.
So are you one of those people that like, because obviously you talked about being on stage and performing too, like, and acting, is writing like your thing now, or are you still always looking at like the other options of entertainment and, you know, creativity that you've experienced in your past?
So, you know, to sort of answer that from a different direction, I came to writing. I had always sort of been a writer, but I ended up minoring in creative writing at NYU in addition to my acting BFA, because a play that I wanted to do called Phaedra's Love, written by Sarah Kane, when I wanted to do it, Sarah Kane's estate was no longer letting college productions happen. So instead, I rewrote Aeschylus's The Oresteia as sort of like not a modern take, but just sort of I rewrote it. And it was this 4-hour thing. NYU produced it. Like it was one of their four shows they did that semester. They let me direct it.
That's awesome.
But it was like, you know, people would show up at 7 and be like limping out of the theater at 11:30. It was a mess. It was a nightmare. It was a good show, but it was just like a lot. And so, fuck, what was your question?
I don't know, but I was just going to say, it's basically like our conversation today is like this entire mess, but like, we're both going to be like, I got to get up out of this chair, but it's like, oh, this was so great. I'm juiced. Like, I was asking like, man, if you like the writing aspect of like, you know, is it like, I've just got to get this out, you
right.
know, kind of thinking about
so,
that. Yeah.
So, you know, part of that was I wanted to do this show. I wanted to do Phaedra's Love. I couldn't do Phaedra's Love. So I have to write this fucking thing, you know, and so much of, and so then I decided to minor in it because, you know, if NYU chooses to do your show, like, hey, this is the first time I really wrote a play. It's being produced. They let me fucking do it. Well, then let me just keep doing it. So I kept writing plays. And then I did a one-on-one directed study with Dr. Stephen Druckman, who is a Pulitzer nominated playwright. And like, these are sorts of opportunities that people don't really get. So I just kept following it. Yeah. Now, it's always to me come from the direction of, if nobody else is going to do this, then I guess I'll do it. If Phaedra's Love had been available to me to produce it, I never would have written that play.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow.
The two books that I have written so far are books that I said to myself, I would really like to read a book that is blankety blankety blank. And I spent weeks looking for them, didn't find them. And I said, well, then I'll do it. It's not because I'm sitting here thinking about what's the type of stuff that I would like to be on the pages that are wrapped in a jacket that says my name on a shelf. It's just not that, because it's not that there's nothing motivating to me about that. That doesn't put me in the chair for hours every day. I want to read that book. So I read it. It just so happens that I get to read it after my fingers type it out. And that's the way that so much of the writing that I've done about sneakers or about everything else has come out of, hey, I want to read an article about this. Who's written this? Nobody else has written this. Fine. Yeah. I'm in the very, very, very early stages of writing a nonfiction book about the history of self-immolation and its impact on our culture, partly because there's a blackout in mass media about talking about self-immolation, because it's such an impactful act that when somebody does self-immolate, 9 times out of 10, their name is never published, mm-hmm. coverage is suppressed, because it causes change, because it motivates people to shift the way they think about things. And I have looked, and there are books there, and there are a lot of doctor's theses, like 500-page doctor's theses about self-immolation, but there isn't the sort of like mass market distillation in like a Dave Cullen Columbine sort of way, or like a Ta-Nehisi Coates or Clint Smith Second Amendment type of way to really look at who has self-immolated, what are their stories, why did they do it, and what impact did it have. Again, there are academic sort of papers about this, but there isn't this sort of like on the wall. And I think that's necessary.
Yeah.
And if somebody else would have written it, I would have read it and I would have posted it on Instagram and been like, I fucking love this book. Everybody should read it. But nobody's done that. There's a book that came out last year in 2024 that's being published in paperback called The Ultimate Protest, about the Vietnamese monk who lit himself on fire that sort of shifted the conversation around Vietnam. But other than that, there's really like not a lot of conversation about that. So many of my projects are that way. I have an idea and I'm like, oh, somebody must have done something about this. And they haven't. And so I sit down to do it. Would I rather I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning last night going over the Hamlet soliloquies. Like, would I love to do Hamlet on Broadway? Absolutely. Is anybody calling me for that? No. But yeah. I have hours tomorrow. I can sit down and I can write about Aaron Bushnell and his self-immolation, because nobody else is doing that. So that's sort of like, you know, I'm a minnow in a river, and I can swim wherever. Minnows live in oceans and lakes, but you know, I have a certain numbers of hours a day. I have a certain number of days in my life, and I have things that I'm interested in and passionate about. And so it just has to come out of my body. That's ultimately what it is. And when it's not, I sit there and I seethe. And people who know me, that, you know, that I'm close with in my personal life, they know that when I'm quiet, it's because I have so much to say that nothing else can, like, until I say the thing. Yeah. I can hear my stepmother saying, just say it, just say what you want to say. And, you know, in one of our arguments, because it'll erupt out of me. And so I write the thing that I cannot stop myself from writing. Now, certainly, you know, when I was doing all my work with Esquire, I would have an idea that I didn't have to do, but I also knew if I write this and I send it to Jonathan and he wants to publish it, I get a couple $100. So that's fucking great. But those long ones that don't get a lot of clicks, it's really because I'm sitting there in the dark, unable to sleep, because it's like, somebody needs to say this. Somebody needs to say this. And if somebody else said it, I will read it and I will share it, but that's not happening.
I totally relate, man. I'm the same way with the, you know, when I'm silent, when I also wear every emotion so blatantly on my face that like the people that know me are like, even if like I can fake it for, you know, a few minutes, like they see it and they're like, Nick's got to take a walk. You know, like this conversation is going to get him too riled up. Like he's going to go, like, you know, I would say, like, you know, maybe in my younger years, that would be like a smoke break. But, you know, it would just be like a thing that got in my brain and whatever analogy, you know, under my skin, it just like, I have to do something with this kind of thing. And like journaling helped with that, you know, for certain things.
Sure. Therapy.
But also like, yeah, therapy, like, you know, like having, you know, the friends and family that, you know, that understands these things and that you're open with about some of these things can take a little bit of that edge off sometimes too. And it's like, it's a constant work in progress, right? It's like, you know, no one thing is the end all be all solution to that for most of us. One thing that it made me, that I've been thinking about the last few years, and maybe this is also about, you know, the COVID years and all of this stuff that's changed about our, you know, journeys as human beings over the last 6-7 years. But like, I started thinking about all of the, you know, we talked about it a little bit before we started recording about just how, you know, as people who have written for, you know, all these different platforms over the years, like a new group of people, and this is not a jab at anybody, but a new group of people will come in and they switch the WordPress or the CMS to a new CMS. And all of a sudden your work from, you know, 7-8 years ago is now no longer on the internet. I've been thinking a lot about that recently, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on it. But like, you know, I've contributed to magazines. My name's in a handful of them over the years. I'm working on like a small sneaker book right now that'll be out later this year. That's like kind of like, you know, it's a part of a series of like collectible things. It's not something that's like me necessarily, but it's like something I definitely can take on and like think I'm qualified enough to write about it, I guess. But then like part of me has also like been thinking about like the tangible physical conversation we've had about like, you know, actually having things and wanting to go find books and records. And, you know, like I'm like, you know, like so many people, like digging into old cameras again that like I had, you know, 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And it's like all of that to say, like, I'm thinking about like the work being erasable in a matter of a delete key, you know, a stroke of the delete key can like take away a majority of my life's work, which is a weird thing to think about.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, not that I even have this idea that I like, I want to hopefully inspire and make people think differently and have conversations, but like, it's really interesting to think about that. And like, books are kind of like that next, feel like that next chapter in a lot of ways, but also like, I'm not wanting it to be just about sneakers, you know, like I know that there are important stories there, but to your point, it's like, does that story need the same reiteration that it's already had in a book form? Am I just doing this because I want to have a book that has my name on it? You know, all those things. And how do you look at that as someone who's kind of also in this like crossover era of like, you know, I'm sure for you in a lot of ways, like writing a play is probably a bucket list thing at one point in your life. Writing for someone like Esquire or GQ is probably like, oh, that's something cool that I'm happy to check off. Like it was for me, you know, like even just sounds weird, but like getting to like share a cubicle and work with Russ Bengston as somebody who read all those slam magazines in high school is like a cool thing. Check it off the bucket list. I'm pretty stoked about that, but all that stuff can just disappear at some point. The internet, you know, buries everything. How do you look at that kind of stuff at this point?
It's a really difficult question for me just because I sort of feel like nothing is real.
Mm.
And so when we think about there was a news cycle that just came out that something like 90% of silent films have been lost because they were never sort of transferred from the reels to something else, so they've all degraded to the point where they're just gone. And I was obsessed with the Library of Alexandria before I really like became a writer. So the idea that even like publishing a book traditionally on paper would sort of last beyond anything is, I think, a fallacy. there's a lot of, and I don't mean this in the negative sense, but there's a lot of ego in that, where, you know, I hear Survivor 50 is coming. And I'm sort of a fan of Survivor. That's what I like did during pandemic, is I had only watched season one, and then I was literally watching a season every day and a half. And in the trailer for Survivor 50, Jeff Probst is like, "This is how you build a legacy." And I'm like, a legacy on a reality competition show?
Yeah.
Like, and maybe depending on sort of how you structure your life, when one of those winners dies, or one of the finalists dies, they'll say on their deathbed, like, "Please remember me as the guy who stood on the pole the longest. Like, that's my legacy." That to me sounds ridiculous. And a part of my ego does want a big shelf of books that have my name on it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that people continue to talk about. That would be great. But for that to even be a consideration, I need to be in the world. I need to be having thoughts. I need to be contributing something, like something of actual value. I love A Song of Ice and Fire, the book series that Game of Thrones is based off of. Mm-hmm. And then you think about, and I remember watching the first episodes of Stranger Things during the RNC in 2016. I was in Las Vegas on a trip with Jordan Brand. And I was tweeting like, "Oh my God, guys, the show is amazing. You have to watch it." And they were like, "What?" And same thing with Squid Game. I was like, "Everybody's got to watch the show." And then you think about those shows and how they ended and how those conversations immediately stopped, because they got really aware of what they were and stopped focusing on doing at the end what they were trying to do at the beginning. And, you know, I'm reading James Baldwin right now. This year I'm reading James Baldwin. Last year I read Octavia Butler. And one of the things that sort of strikes me about Butler, and this is true with a lot of artists, I think the best and most important work that Butler did is not her most famous work. The stuff that she did that sort of shapes my brain today are books that most people haven't heard of. And she only published 14 books under her name, one of which she took out of print and one of which was published posthumously. So, and she's known for Kindred and Parable of the Sower, but I think it's her Xenogenesis trilogy that is like really shows her to be a genius. We don't have control over any of that, right? Like, all we can do is do what we can. And that's sort of, I don't want to say the nexus, but that's where a lot of my frustration around, like, let's write another story about banned Jordans, because it's like, you could spend that time plumbing something else. I wrote this throwaway story that was important to me, that I knew, like, nobody else is going to give a shit about this. It was after the bathroom bill passed in North Carolina, and then the All-Star game was going to be there. Jordan Brand came out with this pair of like iridescent Jordan 1s. They were like iridescent purple. And it really, they sort of struck me as being queer coded. They felt gay to me in a complimentary way.
Yeah.
And so I wrote an article basically being like, Jordan Brand is obviously not going to make a statement about the bathroom bill, but these colors are not about any of these, are not about Charlotte, and they're not about any of the teams. So like, maybe there's something there. And I don't know how many people read this. It published on Esquire, but the people that were working on the Pride collection at the time reached out to me and they said, "We're all reading this and sharing this. Everybody at Nike is reading this and sharing this. And we feel really seen. Thank you for publishing this. You know more about what's going on than you think you know." And that to me is sort of the kernel of what I think you're talking about, which is that we don't know what we don't know what the effect of what we do is going to have, but you have so many hours, you have so many days, you have so many words that you can publish. So for me, I want to make sure that it counts. And I don't mean I'm out here doing the work that's going to save people's lives or whatever. But if I follow the thing that I think is interesting, that is not what the other people are talking about, I put voice to something or shine a light on something that is otherwise not being seen, then that has the potential to sort of hit people in ways that another article about the same fucking thing isn't. And if and when those things turn into a book or whatever, that only has the possibility of happening if I am chasing something that is otherwise not there. You think about, you know, there are properties. I mean, I mentioned a number of them. The one that I think, the one that I haven't said that it was the first one that I thought of is Harry Potter. You think about these properties that make buckets and buckets of money and then within 15 years sort of vanish. Mm-hmm. Because what makes money inherently has to be something that audiences are primed to consume, which means that it inherently cannot be something that's brand new. But the things that have staying power are new and tend not to be very successful in their time, which is not to say like, I'm not successful, which means that what I do is important. That's not the causation.
Yep.
But we have to think about how we measure what success is. And for me, it's always, is this thing successfully doing the thing it's trying to do? Not, did it get all the clicks? Is it, yep. You know, like if that were the case, General Hospital, Taylor Swift, these would all be sort of like the creative paragons of our time.
Yep.
And they're just not. And so, which is not to say that, like, again, just because people click on the Kardashians does not mean that the same people that click on the Kardashians are not capable of clicking on things that are enriching and full. And just because Everywhere, Everything, All at Once won the Oscar, that's not what makes that movie a good movie. What makes that movie a good movie is that it's a fucking good movie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And so we have to really decouple ourselves from the word that I've been using recently, from assessment, and sort of saying, okay, the number of clicks, the sort of financial success of this or the popular success of this determines whether or not this is good, whether or not this is worthwhile or valuable. Some work is valuable in and of itself. But the likelihood of something like that turning into a book or turning into a movie is higher if the quality of the work is higher. You can direct yourself towards financial success, as so much of the work that we have done is. These pieces that sort of vanish on the internet. For many years, I worked at an artist agency where I interviewed and wrote up and I wrote up an interview with an artist every day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year. That's 250 interviews a wow. year. I got very efficient at it and got a lot of good shit down in there. And after I left and I went to StockX, they went in a different direction with their marketing and they deleted it all. It was over 1,000 artist interviews. And I, you know, like that was upsetting to discover. I wish they had emailed me and been like, we're going to delete this in 6 hours, take down what, you know, grab what you want to grab. That would have been nice. Yeah. They didn't owe that to me, but it would have been nice. But the point of that work was not to create the archive, right? The point of that work was to have those conversations. The point of, and this is a Substack article that I'm writing. The point of a puzzle is to do the puzzle. It's not to have the finished picture because the picture is on the box, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I always put the picture away and figure out the puzzle with the pieces because otherwise I'm just, AI could do that, right? Otherwise it's just a sorting process. And so, yes, it sucks when these things get deleted, but also like if people were still clicking on that, they wouldn't delete it. So it has fulfilled its purpose. And the ego, of course, is upset. And the bigger part of my ego has already copied, pasted it and put it on a different place, right? Because because I want to hold that. But otherwise, like, so much of this is just is recognizing what I'm doing, right? And, you know, I had a conversation recently with my mom where she was talking about, you've done all these cool things, and I've done like a lot of really cool things. But I think part of this too, and this is a distinct part of my perspective on this, my goal has never been to like be the guy, the sneaker guy. Like, that's never been a goal, to be the definitive voice about sneakers. So if all that stuff disappears, if I have never had done that stuff, like, I sort of don't really care. Because to me, you know, I know when I sit down, like, you had sent a question like, what are the coolest things that you've done, or like the things that you're most proud of? And I think about like getting H. White on the record about sneaker violence being the first time anyone from Jordan has ever made a statement, because I was able to read the room and realize the PR people weren't paying attention. I was able to sneak that question in, and what he said was insane and just like horrific. Like, that's cool. And I make sure that I have that, because that is something.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is like, and there are cool things, but it's like, do I want my count to be a bunch of cool things? That doesn't really matter to me.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that, I don't know, I guess I'm so focused on what I'm doing next. I'm really interested in the work of it, in the putting together the puzzles. When the puzzles are done, it's like, cool. The goal wasn't to be done. The work was putting the puzzle together.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go work on my next puzzle.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's a satisfying answer.
No, it's really interesting. I think probably also to people that are going to listen to this, because for so much of, you know, what people think is the goal, like, that is not what a lot of the people that I know that do this type of stuff do it for, right? Like, you know, I'm going to generalize and minimize this whole thing into like sneaker content, right?
Yeah.
Like, people think that people like you and I or Jacques Slade or whomever, we put all this stuff out there because we wanted a free pair of shoes. Like, that is what so many readers, air quotes there, followers and whatever, that's what they think it's about. But for me, that like disappeared before I even got to write about sneakers. Like, for me, like, it was, you know, my brother and, you know, a couple of close friends, like, having those experiences of lining up for shoes or, you know, going on a trip someplace and being like, oh, we're going to go find the local cool spot to check out, you know, whether, you know, whatever city or town, right? It's just like the experience of that and sharing it with each other was what we loved about it. And then it was like, became a thing that like I figured out. And like I said, I just lucked out and being like, I was obsessed with these things, and they became an opportunity for me to earn a living doing something connected to something that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
But ultimately, when I think back about the stuff that I've accomplished, most of the things are not the things that got clicks. They're not the things that like people would look at. There are a couple of cool things that I've done, but like, you know, one of my favorite moments was like me and Jacques sitting watching Robin Givens at the ESPY Awards because of sneakers. And like, I get goosebumps about it because it was an emotional experience for me. And like, getting to see her talk about her journey live right there, just because I liked sneakers and connected the dots between sports and sneakers enough to where it mattered. So somebody said, hey, you should go experience this. And like, I'm not even like an awards show. Like, I've never watched those shows, but being able to be there and see it, like, and like feel it, and like think, man, like, this is just a couple of people, me and Jacques, just like literally just, I remember leaning over to him and being like, we're sitting here because of sneakers, like, because we just nerded out about these stupid things, you know, like, it's such a weird experience. But also, it's like one of those things where, like, I think you're spot on. Like, I also question the legacy stuff. Like, there are days when I think about it, there are days that I don't care about it, there are days that I think, this is all just part of the matrix and I don't give a shit about any of it. Like,
yeah.
But then it's like, also like, okay, like there's something about me kind of getting back into the writing, whether that's, you know, like this year, my goal is 1,000 words a day, whatever that is. It's just to keep my thoughts from getting bottled up inside. And some of that is going to be sneaker stuff, which is great because I can put it someplace. Some of it is super personal, me trying to figure out like all the feelings of that, the grief that we talked about before we started recording, all of those things that like you can't have a conversation with someone that doesn't, you know, that like for me to explain, let's say for me to explain all the background that got me to the point of the grief that I'm feeling this morning is hours, days worth of conversation for you as someone who doesn't know me that well to understand, you know, and you probably have a better, it, just based on my conversation with you today, you probably have a better understanding of those things than most, but like, think about that. I think about that. I think about processing it. And like writing is ultimately the thing that I lean on when like, I just need to like keep moving forward and the rest will figure itself out. And like, it's been a struggle to get back to that, but it's also really kind of the questions that you're having, the thought process that you're like triggering for me is also really fascinating. Even going back to what you were saying about how your process of writing is really fascinating to me. And like, I know we've been on here for a long time, so I'm not going to go too far down that rabbit hole, but maybe we have another conversation down the road about that, because I sometimes am almost the exact opposite. Like there are times when it's like the thing I need to say is so simple. Mm-hmm. That becomes it may not be the published title of something, but it is 100% the thing that I need to say. It might take me 5,000 words to get that message across, but it's a 4 or 5 sentence, like, just be a good fucking person and don't screw over people. Like that can be like the thing. And then it's like, oh, Bad Bunny at the Super Bowl, blah, word vomit of all these things. But like at the end of the day, like I also know that there's people behind these brands that feel it, see it, to your point about the Charlotte Jordan connection. Like, and those are the moments where I get back into being reminded that like none of this is about me. Like it is, it's getting a lot of stuff off of my chest and me trying to process what I see and, you know, consume and take in or whatever. But when I get those feelings or emotions or reflections back from those things where like, you know, like you kind of alluded to earlier, it's like you can write something that's like for 8 people or that 8 people see. And like, you never really know if that writing is for you or for someone else. It kind of bounces back and forth. But when you have those moments of like confirmation of something that you care deeply about, like that is like, I don't know if it's a healthy drug, but it is the best drug for me. Like it is like, there is somebody out there, and it's become more of that in the last, you know, 10 years of this chaos that we live in, where it's like, there's something real and tangible about the feelings that I'm having and I'm sharing. And that, you know, and then when I do a show like this and talk to somebody like you, and it's like, we've had like a 4-hour conversation today about so many different things, and it's been so great. Because like you get to feel that like other people have these feelings that like we're just not processing. So
yeah, that is something that I'm trying to figure out. And I think it's sort of like part of why my publishing on Substack has slowed down a little bit, is because I'm really interested, or I'm grappling with, what is the function of this? And at the same time, that with, you are the least interesting thing about you. That's a phrase that sort of like is working its way through me. And so I'm trying to figure out, how do I create work that has a function, that is doing something for people, that is not just a bunch of I statements? Because there's a journal, like you can have a journal that's like, I feel this, I experience this, et cetera, et cetera. But as a reader, I'm not interested in reading that. As a writer, as a human being who wants to feel seen and listened to, I want to write about those things. But I don't know what the function of that is for other people. And I want my work to be functional. I want it to be useful. And so the thing that I was talking about with the puzzles, I'm trying to find a way into that that is not, because I think that that's a useful functional thought, a useful functional idea, but I don't know how to write it in a way that's not, I did this and I had this thought, and isn't that smart?
Yeah.
And I think that this is like, and to me, really good fiction does this. I'm thinking specifically about like Giovanni's Room, where if you, a really good, like skinny novel says a lot of things, but it doesn't say the thing that you walk away with it. That's not a phrase. It's not a sentence. It doesn't say the thing that you're walking away with. And this is something that I write in the margins of my own drafts. I say you're too on top of it. You're saying the thing that yeah. you want the audience to hear and take in. But if you say the thing, then the audience isn't doing work with you. And you want the audience to do work with you. Otherwise, if everything you have to say boils down to four or five sentences, that's great. Publish those four or five sentences. It doesn't need the rest of it, right? Because that's the work has been done. And so the question for me is, okay, so then what's the work beyond that? And that's what, you know, that's why I'm writing so much fiction, because, you know, the book that I just finished the zero draft with, the central question is, how do we live in a world, this world that we've made? It takes place like 50 years in the future. So you can imagine like all the shitty things that we're going through now, they're much worse. And how do you sort of like look at your parents who created a lot of the shit that we're dealing with right now? How do you not blame them in every moment of every day? How do you not get like just overwhelmed by grief and anger at all times, and recognizing that the grief and the anger is there? How do you continue to move? How do you not give up? What is nihilism? What is the function of nihilism? What is ecstatic nihilism? And then the question is, if that's what I want the audience to have, how do I give them that experience? Not tell them that experience, not say those things that I just said, but put that in their body. There's, you know, the work that we have done. I mean, you think about Twitter, Instagram, is so much of distilling that down into the sentence. But because we are now in a place where, you know, I think we're in a post-advertising world where people are just sort of flowing on content and flowing on discourse rather than engaging with it, we need to find the ways to pull people in ways that they don't even see. I have these Dungeon Crawler Carl books behind me, which is this series that is really popping off. And it is about, you know, a guy living on the planet Earth. He tries to save his ex-girlfriend's cat in the middle of a snowstorm, and then aliens come and destroy the world and turn it inside of the Earth into this dungeon game that's basically like streamed online, and it's very much like Dark Souls-y or like Final Fantasy Dungeons and Dragons. And it's fun and it's exciting, and the words, you can read them like water. They're so easy to read. But if you take a half step back, you realize that it's this really great deconstruction of capitalism and the ruling class and how we use entertainment and all this sorts of stuff. And it wasn't until like book four or five that some people started to catch on. It was like when people, when fans of The Boys realized that Homelander was actually the villain of the show and they all like freaked out. Same thing happened with Dungeon Crawler Carl. They're like, I don't like how this has turned into politics when it's been political since page one.
Yeah,
and that's sort of like, that's the magic trick that is our job. And you and I have been in this position along with many other writers where we were living in a world where we didn't have to do that.
Yep.
We did the thing. You know, to what you said earlier, there were articles that I wrote so that the brands would send me the shoes. And most of time they did. And that was fun. But it was mostly about like having these conversations in very direct, simple ways so that people would understand. Are we coming back to a blog ecosystem? I don't know. What I do know is I want my work to do more. I want it to have this utility beyond the CTA at the bottom that says buy now. And I think that there are ways in to do that. And I think that if you're really looking, if you are seeing a story that's obvious. And you say, there's obviously a story here. Well, that person's going to write it. That person would write that. What's the story that I would write? What's the thing that like I would almost be embarrassed to say? That's the one that you should write, because that's the one that has utility.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that's a pretty good spot to wrap. Let people chew on that, because I mean, we're going to have to do this another time. You know, this conversation has been phenomenal for me. Like, I think, you know, more people need to have these types of conversations too, to just think about the things that we're just thrown into, you know?
Yeah.
We went so many different directions, but even just in like thinking about the, you know, parents and, you know, what, where we exist now, how we exist now, all these different aspects of it. And, you know, it is really interesting, because like we barely talked about anything that I thought we would talk about, but like, I'm so glad that it went the directions that it did, because it's just been really great to chat with you about this stuff. I feel like this has been a little bit of a therapy session for me too, to ask some of the, you know, to like hear your take on some of these things, which is really fascinating. But I guess like, as I wrap this up, like, where should people find you, you know? Yeah, man. I have so many other thoughts. I'm gonna bite my tongue for now, because we've been talking for a couple hours as we're recording, and we've got 3.5 hours on top of that. Yeah,
yeah. I'm in most places. I'm Pete_Forrester. That's Forrester with one R, and then on Substack, it's without the underscore. I'm very Googleable. I hate to say that, but I'm very Googleable. You'll find me. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I appreciate all the time, man. This has been really awesome to chat with you finally, and
yeah.
Looking forward to the next time we can do it. But thanks again for being on the show. And I'll hope everybody that's listening, watching, wherever you're seeing this, tuning in, definitely give Pete a follow and check in with him. He's doing some cool stuff out there and making me think. Definitely going to make you think with his stuff too. So
thank you.
Thanks, everybody.